Welcome to Tungsten, Bulletproof Hacks for the Moth-Eaten. Tungsten broadcasts at the saddest hour on Wet'suwet'en territory through CICK 93.9 FM in Smithers, BC. Given we're cruising through a three-part series on mystery novels, you, Zed, should call me Omega, your grandmotherly accomplice for the next half hour. In part two, I want to introduce cozy mysteries. There are tons of great classics and modern cozy mystery authors to read, but our focus in this episode is the subgenre historical mystery with Ellis Peters. A good mystery, and particularly a trusted protagonist, will keep you excellent company when you're feeling under the weather. Come on, Zed, let's go get into some cozy mischief together. In last week's episode, I described the genre cozy mysteries as one that usually takes place around a small or closed setting and typically involves a specific set of people. Cozy mysteries are tidy, where the mystery is solved and the perpetrator caught. They're also defined by their lack of graphic violence, explicit sex, or foul language. Sounds kind of grandmotherly, doesn't it? Well, I've always liked this genre, even as a youth. What I like best about a mystery series is that I don't have to be introduced to the protagonist every time I pick up a book. I already know who I'm dealing with and that they can be trusted. Catfail has always been reliable for me. He makes me feel safe regardless of what's happening in the story. I don't fret while the plot is unfolding because I feel the good brother has things under control. I can also enjoy watching the mystery unfold even if I can't figure it all out as it's happening, because Ellis Peters doesn't hold her cards so close that I'm entirely in the dark the whole time. Now you may not care a tinker's cuss for that, but it makes me feel included. Ellis Peters was the pen name of English novelist Edith Partridger, who died in 1995. Partridger wrote scores of books under her own name and was recipient of several prestigious awards conferred both by the Crime Writers Association of Great Britain and the Mystery Writers of America. She's probably best known for her murder mysteries, both historical and modern, particularly this medieval detective series, The Cadfael Chronicles. These chronicles are often credited for popularizing the genre historical mystery. Peter's writing is well-researched and whimsical, and I've often wished I could visit Brother Cadfael in his hut to learn more about his herbs and tinctures, as well as to understand better the Welsh history and culture. And I'm not alone. Online, I learned that the Cadfael Chronicles drew international attention to the town of Shrewsbury, which increased tourism there. In a 1993 interview, Edith Partridger mentioned her work as a chemist's assistant before the Second World War. And I quote, "We used to make bottled medicine that we compounded specially, with ingredients like gentian, rosemary, horehound. You never see that nowadays. Those tinctures are never prescribed. They often had bitters of some sort in them, a taste I rather liked. Some of Cadfael's prescriptions come out of those years." I personally was raised Catholic, but left the church in high school. Obviously, Brother Cadfael follows some strict religious observances, which are included for reference, but which never feel pressurized. I found a comment that suggested that this series demonstrates a great appreciation for the ideals of medieval Catholic Christianity, alongside a recognition of its weaknesses, illustrated in novels like The Heretic's Apprentice, where the characters quarrel over the finer points of theology, or The Rose Rent, where part of the plot revolves around the church wanting more land and wealth. So, rather than being indoctrinated into a faith, or even outright proselytization, I'm agreeable to accompanying the brothers to Vespers. One of the things I like a lot about Ellis Peters' series is her attention to detail. It sometimes feels like I'm entering a world not unlike J.R.R. Tolkien's Middle Earth, where you can engage with a new culture using maps and a language. The thing is, Peters' maps are accurate representations of Wales, with improvisations of church and farmlands related to each story, and how the country might have been affected by warring factions. The Cadfael series is based in 12th century Wales, and centers on an abbey that historically existed. Peters also includes pages of the Welsh language so that you can at least attempt correct pronunciation of terms and phrases included in the stories. Solving the murder is amusing and a good exercise for my brain, but the social, economic, and political immersion into the Welsh culture reminds me of my younger days traveling to other countries and immersing myself as much into the local culture as possible while there. Thank you. Next, I want to read part of this first chapter that introduces Cat Vale and his world to the reader. It's a kind of world that sometimes I'd like to escape entirely into, to learn about herbs and humans and learning patience and diplomacy. It's a world that I might in another life have welcomed. Who knows? On the fine bright morning in early May, when the whole sensational affair of the Gwythyrn relics may properly be considered to have begun, Brother Cadfael had been up long before prime, pricking out cabbage seedlings before the day was aired, and his thoughts were all on birth, growth, and fertility, not at all on graves and reliquaries and violent deaths, whether of saints, sinners, or ordinary, decent, fallible men like himself. Nothing troubled his peace but the necessity to take himself indoors for Mass and the succeeding half-hour of chapter, which was always liable to stray over by an extra 10 minutes. He grudged the time from his more congenial labors out here among the vegetables, but there was no evading his duty. He had, after all, chosen this cloistered life with his eyes open. He could not complain even of those parts of it he found unattractive, when the whole suited him very well, and gave him the kind of satisfaction he felt now, as he straightened his back and looked about him. He doubted if there was a finer Benedictine garden in the whole kingdom, or one better supplied with herbs both good for spicing meats and also invaluable as medicine. The main orchards and lands of the Shrewsbury Abbey of St. Peter and St. Paul lay on the northern side of the road, outside the monastic enclave, and here, in the enclosed garden within the walls, close to the abbot's fish ponds and the brook that worked the abbey mill, Brother Cadfael ruled unchallenged. The herbarium, in particular, was his kingdom, for he had built it up gradually through the 15 years of labor, and added to it many exotic plants of his own careful raising, collected in a roving youth that had taken him as far afield as Venice and Cyprus and the Holy Land. For Brother Cadfael had come late to the monastic life, like a battered ship settling at last for a quiet harbor. He was well aware that in the first years of his vows, the novices and lay servants had been wont to point him out to one another with odd whisperings. "See that brother working in the garden there? The thick-set fellow who rolls from one leg to the other like a sailor? You wouldn't think to look at him, would you, that he went on crusade when he was young? He was with Godfrey de Bouillon at Antioch, where the Saracens surrendered it. And he took to the seas as a captain when the King of Jerusalem ruled all the coast of the Holy Land, and served against the Corsairs 10 years. Hard to believe it now, eh?" Brother Cadfael himself found nothing strange in his wide-ranging career, and had forgotten nothing and regretted nothing. He saw no contradiction in the delight he had taken in battle and adventure, and the keen pleasure he now found in quietude. Spiced, to be truthful, with more than a little mischief when he could get it, as he liked his victuals well-flavored, but quietude all the same, a ship becalmed and enjoying it. And probably the youngsters who eyed him with such curiosity also whispered that in a life such as he had led there must have had some encounters with women, and not all purely chivalrous. And what sort of grounding was that for the conventual life? They were right about the women. Quite apart from Shildis, who had unnaturally tired of waiting for his return after 10 years, and married a solid yeoman with good prospects in the shire, and no intention of flying off to the wars, he remembered other ladies, in more lands than one, with whom he had enjoyed encounters pleasurable to both parties, and no harm to either. Bianca, drawing water at the stone wellhead in Venice. The Greek boat girl, Ariana. Miriam, the Saracen widow who sold spices and fruit in Antioch, and who found him man enough to replace for a while the man she had lost. The light encounters and the grave, not one of them had left any hard feelings behind. He counted as achievement enough, and having known them was part of the harmonious balance that made him content now with his harbored contemplative life, and gave him patience and insight to bear with those cloistered simple souls who had put on the Benedictine habit as a life's profession, while for him it was a timely retirement. When you have done everything else, perfecting a conventual herb garden is a fine and satisfying thing to do. He could not conceive of coming to this stasis, having done nothing else whatever. 5 minutes more and he must wash his hands and repair to the church for Mass. He used the respite to walk the length of his pale-flowered, fragrant inner kingdom, where Brother John and Brother Columbanus, two youngsters barely a year tonsured, were busy weeding and edge-trimming. Glossy and dim, oiled and furry, the leaves tendered every possible variation on green. The flowers were mostly shy, small, almost furtive, in soft, sidelong colors, lilacs and shadowy blues and diminutive yellows, for they were the unimportant and unwanted part, but for ensuring seed to follow. Rue, sage, rosemary, gilvers, gromwell, ginger, mint, thyme, columbine, herb of grace, savory, mustard, every manner of herb grew here, fennel, tansy, basil and dill, parsley and chervil, and marjoram. He had taught the uses even of the unfamiliar to all his assistants, and made plain their dangers, too, for the benefit of herbs is in their right proportion, and overdosage can be worse than the disease. Small of habit, modest of tint, close-growing and shy, his herbs called attention to themselves only by their disseminated sweetness as the sun rose on them. But behind their shrinking ranks rose others taller and more clamorous, banks of peonies grown for their spice seeds, and lofty pale-leaved budding poppies, as yet barely showing the white or purple-black petals through their close armor. They stood as tall as a short man, and their home was the eastern part of the Middle Sea, and from that far place Cadfael had brought their ancestors in the seed long ago, and raised and crossbred them in his own garden, before ever he perfected progeny here with him to make medicines against pain, the chief enemy of man. Pain and the absence of sleep, which is the most beneficial remedy for pain. This next selection demonstrates Peter's exceptional ability to introduce a new character, where Cadfael notices minutiae that include doing the detective work of understanding the personality, often becoming empathetic to their situation and seeing them through the perspective of their particular situation or chosen career. It came as a shattering shock when a sudden stir at the door, prompt to the hour appointed, blew into the hall a small, round, unimpressive person in the Benedictine habit, hugging to him an armful of vellum rolls and followed by his black-gowned brothers in close attendance. Cadfael, too, was observing him with interest, for it was the first time he had seen him clearly. A modest man of comfortable figure and amiable countenance, rosy and mild. Not so old as the night journey had suggested, perhaps 45, with a shining innocence about him. But to Roger Modwead, it might have been a fire-breathing dragon entering the hall. I'd also like to read the first page of one of three short stories published alongside a rare Benedictine, which also chronicles the early years of Cadfael's monastic life. This is another of those descriptions that bring the medieval world to life, making each character both realistic and likable. One of my favorite Cadfael traits is his ability to be both sensible and empathetic to everyone. Hamo Fitzhamon of Lydiat held two fat manors in the northeastern corner of the county, towards the border of Cheshire. Though a gross feeder, a heavy drinker, a self-indulgent lecher, a harsh landlord, and a brutal master, he had reached the age of 60 in the best of health, and it came as a salutary shock to him when he was at last taken with a mild seizure, and for the first time in his life saw the next world yawning before him, and woke to the uneasy consciousness that it might see fit to treat him somewhat more austerely than this world had done. Though he repented none of them, he was aware of a whole register of acts in his past, which heaven might construe as heavy sins. It began to seem to him a prudent precaution to acquire merit for his soul as quickly as possible. Also as cheaply, for he was a grasping and possessive man. A judicious gift to some holy house should secure the welfare of his soul. There was no need to go so far as endowing an abbey or a new church of his own. The Benedictine Abbey of Shrewsbury could put up a powerful assault of prayers on his behalf in return for a much more modest gift. The thought of alms to the poor, however ostentatiously bestowed in the first place, did not recommend itself. Whatever was given would be soon consumed and forgotten, and a ragtag of beggarly blessings from the indigent could carry very little weight, besides failing to confer a lasting luster upon himself. No, he wanted something that would continue in daily use and daily respectful notice, a permanent reminder of his munificence and piety. He took his time about making his decision, and when he was satisfied to the best value he could get for the least expenditure, he sent his lawman to Shrewsbury to confer with abbot and prior, and conclude with due ceremony and many witnesses the charter that conveyed to the custodian of the altar of St. Mary, within the abbey church, one of his free tenant farmers, the rent to provide light for Our Lady's altar throughout the year. He promised also, for the proper displaying of his charity, the gift of a pair of fine silver candlesticks, which he himself would bring and see installed on the altar at the coming Christmas feast. Another selection from The Price of Light. This one illustrates for me Peter's ability to see both the beauty of the church and some of its failings. The hunger for land and money was a big concern in medieval times, for instance. I also enjoy the interplay of the characters and how Cadfael sees through them all, but so gently, with humility and kindness. Brother Oswald said grievously, "I wish he had directed his charity better. Surely, these are wonderful things, a delight to the eyes. But well sold, they could have provided money enough to buy the means of keeping my poorest petitioners alive through the winter, some of whom will surely die for want of them." Brother Jerome was scandalized. "Has he not given them to Our Lady herself?" he lamented indignantly. "Beware of the sin of those apostles who cried out the same complaint against the woman who brought the pot of spikenard and poured it over the Savior's feet. Remember our Lord's reproof to them, that they should let her alone, for she had done well." "Our Lord was acknowledging a well-meant impulse of devotion," said Brother Oswald with spirit. "He did not say it was well advised. 'She hath done what she could,' is what he said. He never said that with a little thought she might not have done better. What use would it have been to wound the giver after the thing was done? Spilled oil of spikenard could hardly be recovered." His eyes dwelt with love and compunction upon the silver lilies, with their tall stems of wax and flame, for these remained, and to divert them to other use was still possible, or would have been if the donor had been a more approachable man. He had, after all, a right to dispose as he wished of his own property. "It is sin," admonished Jerome sanctimoniously, "even to covet for an other use, however worthy, that which has been given to Our Lady. The very thought is sin." "Oh, if Our Lady could make her own well known," said Brother Catfell dryly, "we might learn which is the graver sin, and which the more acceptable sacrifice." "Could any price be too high for the lighting of this holy altar?" demanded Jerome. It was a good question, Catfell thought, as they went to supper in the refectory. "Ask Brother Jordan, for instance, the value of light." Jordan was old and frail, and gradually going blind. As yet he could distinguish shapes, but like shadows in a dream, though he knew his way around cloisters and precincts so well that his gathering darkness was no hindrance to his freedom of movement. But as every day the twilight closed in on him by a shade, so did his profound love of light grow daily more devoted, until he had forsaken other duties, and taken upon himself to tend all the lamps and candles on both altars, for the sake of being always irradiated by light, and sacred light at that. As soon as compline was over this evening, he would be busy devoutly trimming the wicks of candle and lamp to make the steady flames smokeless and immaculate for the matins of Christmas Day. Doubtful if he would go to his bed at all until matins and lauds were over. The very old need little sleep, and sleep is itself a kind of darkness. But what Jordan treasured was the flame of light, and not the vessel holding it. And would not those splendid 2-pound candles shine upon him just as well from plain wooden sconces? You've been listening to Tungsten, Bulletproof Hacks for the Moth-Eaten, at CICK 93.9 FM in Smithers, BC, and I'm Christine Bruce. Are your finances in a state? Is the whole process of doing your taxes a big mystery? May I recommend the services of Accounting on Broadway? Barbara and Brigida are the masterminds behind this accounting and bookkeeping business, which specializes in accounting for small businesses and tax services for personal accounts, small businesses, and farms. Accounting on Broadway is a proud member of the Canadian Bookkeeping Association. Take the mystery out of your income taxes with trusted gumshoes, Barbara and Brigida. You may have noticed that I like to include multiple life hacks in each episode, in case the main hack isn't working for someone. In addition to the cozy mystery selections, I went to my contact at the Smithers Community Services Association, Laura Dursma, for a conversation on the Story Walk project, for which I'm a volunteer. The stories chosen for February, March, and April of this year are exceptional, and I wanted to encourage all my young and young at heart listeners to read these books, alone or with a buddy, with or without accompanying physical activities. Laura, it's really great to have you here.
Thanks, Christine. It's pretty amazing to be here.
All right, tell me about StoryWalk. What is this thing and how does it work?
StoryWalk is amazing. It is an opportunity for families to get together and to share an amazing story. And so what we do is we take a story and we actually take it apart and put it in chunks. And you can go page by page and read the story together.
Now, is it only for families or could one person go and do it or?
Absolutely.
Any age?
We like to say that it can appeal to absolutely anyone of any age.
Great.
I want to give a shout out to Josie McLean of the Northwest Child Development Center here for the terrific activities that go along with the stories.
Mm-hmm. Josie is so amazing and creative. And what she does is she makes activity cards to go alongside each page. And we like to try and match each of the activities alongside with what's happening in the story.
So we might have a little penguin paddling along beside us, or a giraffe running down the campus beside us, or we might be skipping.
You never know what you're going to end up doing. I think that's the best part.
I really like that we've got physical literacy happening between pages of a story.
Get out there and get active.
So there's no set of rules for how a story walk is executed, which is very nice because every community can make those decisions based on their audience, their geography, and the weather, and how they feel that day. Mm-hmm. And I love the flexibility of it all.
Story walk actually is put up in lots of different countries around the world. And what's really cool about it is communities can kind of take the project and run with it. So what we do here in Smithers is we switch up our story each month. So it's really great. So you can go ahead and read the story, but know that the next month when you come out, there will be something totally different to read and enjoy.
And the physical books themselves always have to be vetted. Now, I didn't realize this when I first joined as a volunteer, but every book has to be looked at pretty carefully, the physical book itself, but also the story. So why don't you talk about that a little bit?
What we do is we meet together and we come up, usually each of us comes with some suggestions and some ideas. There are certain things that we try to stay away from. Books are really exciting when they have like lift the flap. Can you spot something underneath? But of course, when we laminate the pages, that doesn't really work so well.
Right.
Some books are just way too long. Some have way too many words on the page. And then, of course, it's just really important to us to have a really great story that goes along with our story walk. So we try really hard to make our stories something that's going to be accessible for everyone to come and enjoy. We believe strongly in having messages of kindness and inclusion and community and caring. Yeah, it's quite a process to pick out the books for each month, but it's also a really great time to get together and talk about good books.
Yeah. And again, back to Josie once more. She had a whole bunch of activities one month with kids who obviously had accessibility issues. So mm-hmm. There was a blind child, there was a child in a wheelchair, there were children with walkers, and they were pictures of these kids doing the activities alongside you. And I thought, wow, this really screams of the Smithers inclusivity. Mm-hmm. It just makes it so obvious that it's important that everybody can do these stories.
A space for everyone.
Now, here in Smithers, our story walk has been erected on permanent boards along the fence in front of Walnut Park Elementary School. And it turns out that's an ideal location because our previous location along Lois Lane in Heritage Park was attracting vandals. Now, that was a real shame because it was a very public place where any age might serendipitously trip over it and be able to read it while they're walking.
Yeah, this is something where I can give a shout out to the person who filled this position before me, to Caroline. She was really passionate about Story Walk. And so this place was selected originally at Lois Lane. That was just a really neat opportunity, like you said, for people to just spontaneously come upon the story walk. But yeah, there have been times where people have vandalized the story. So yeah, now we have a permanent location at Walnut Park Elementary School. And people might not quite as quickly just come upon the story, but it does also attract a number of school kids and classes that come on out and enjoy the story. So
right. Mm-hmm. And there's a little nursery in there, and I see those kids coming out and reading
sure.
it with somebody.
Yes, yes. So yeah. That's always fun too.
And do you remember that day? There was a fellow who was obviously a teacher or a leader of some sort, and he had teenagers mm-hmm. with him, and they were all reading the story. And when they realized that we were connected with it, every one of them had a recommendation for what kind of stories yes. they wanted to see on this thing.
And that's something we encourage people as well. If you have an idea or something that might make a great story walk, you're welcome always to reach out, share your ideas.
Now, I bring this up because our current location in front of school might suggest to people that the project really is only intended for kids. But as we've been saying, any age can enjoy this. In fact, whenever Laura and I go and put this thing up, we're giggling because the stories are so good.
We definitely want everyone to know that you're welcome at Story Walk. Remember, we had someone, an adult middle-aged, who came and shared that they love seeing the new story that's put up each month. So I would suggest that anybody would enjoy coming through and reading the Story Walk.
Okay, tell us about the current book that we've got.
So we've selected The Dot, which, if you're familiar with it, is written and illustrated by Peter H. Reynolds. It has an excellent message, but we're also just really impressed by how understated the illustrations are. They definitely convey the underlying message that less is more. So I would say we shouldn't expect so much of ourselves. Don't overcomplicate things.
Would you mind if we read a few lines out of it? Shall we read maybe the first few pages of it, and just to give people a sense of how great this book is?
Sounds great.
All right.
Okay, here we go. Art class was over, but Vashti sat glued to her chair. Her paper was empty.
Yeah, she looks pretty woebegone, doesn't she?
Mm-hmm.
Vashti's teacher leaned over the blank paper. "Ah, a polar bear in a snowstorm," she said. "Oh, very funny," said Vashti. "I just can't draw."
Her teacher smiled. "Just make a mark and see where it takes you." Vashti grabbed a marker and gave the paper a good, strong jab. There.
You know what? I felt exactly like that a
Absolutely.
Few times at art. Her teacher picked up the paper and studied it carefully. She pushed the paper toward Vashti and quietly said, "Now sign it."
Vashti thought for a moment. "Well, maybe I can't draw, but I can sign my name."
The next week, when Vashti walked into art class, she was surprised to see what was hanging above her teacher's desk. It was the little dot she had drawn. Her dot, all framed in swirly gold. And if you want to hear more,
go and read it.
That's such a fabulous little story of encouraging somebody who doesn't think they can do it.
I think we've all been there, really.
Yeah.
Right? So there you go. Make your mark.
It's got a really nice message, this book.
It does.
If the March book's illustrations were understated, and they really were, it's mostly white pages with very little, you know, smaller pictures on it. I mean, they're just representative of a white page with a dot on it,
mm-hmm.
you know. So it is very understated. But the February illustrations, they almost jumped onto the pavement and they were walking beside you. The author does such a great job of making the creatures feel accessible and interesting without making them seem cartoonish. Mm. And I think that's the problem I see with a lot of books. They're trying to make the animals feel like they're friendly, and so they turn them into cartoons.
Yeah, this definitely had a real appeal to it. So we had the story Edward the Emu by Sheena Knowles and illustrated by Rod Clement. So we can thank him for the amazing illustrations. It's bold, it's adventurous, it's curious. We have our main character, Edward, and he experiments. He goes along to all different cages. And I can't give away too much of this story, but he's really made to feel welcome. I think it's fair to state that he learns that the best place is always in your own skin, without giving away the sweet welcome home he's treated to. Edward is a cutie.
I love Edward. All right. Edward the Emu was sick of the zoo. There was nowhere to go. There was nothing to do. And compared to the seals that lived right next door, well, being an emu was frankly a bore.
So that night, when the zookeeper went home to bed, Edward jumped from his pen and he laughed as he said, "The seals are best and anybody can tell. So tomorrow, I'll just be a seal as well."
I love the look on the seal's face. The next morning at 9, when they opened the zoo, the seals were swimming and Edward was too. He dived in the water and basked in the sun, and he balanced a ball on his beak just for fun.
I just love the look, the two of them staring at each other.
Let's go to the snakes.
Mm.
Oh, yeah. Here, take it away.
The next morning at 9, when they opened the zoo, the snakes were all hissing, and Edward was too. He slipped round the rocks. It was magic to see. Then he curled himself casually up round a tree.
Oh, Edward, you goof. And he keeps doing that and keeps finding creatures that, oh no, this one's best. This one's best.
But if only we could tell you the end of the story.
Every one of them is best. Every one of them has something great to see.
Totally.
And I think that's the moral of the story is everybody has something.
Yeah, it's a really incredible story from start to finish. We love it.
We do. If you don't mind, I'd love to talk about the April book while I have you here.
Let's discover it.
This book when I was babysitting my two crushes, Ted and Skip, and they'd selected The Pirate's Bed as part of their monthly library visit. So, take it away.
It's called The Pirate's Bed by Nicole Winstanley, illustrated by Matt James. It's less for us about the illustrations and more about the whimsy of an unexpected protagonist, the bet. It was a sturdy bet and sensible. It knew there was nothing to do but wait and see. For some time, the bet was very happy in its new life. The pirate was fat and heavy and had never changed his socks. His snoring had shaken the hull of the ship and rattled everything in the cabin. The straw mattress had been scratchy and full of fleas and other bugs. The bed had wondered then what it would be like to be free of the pirate's hulking, sleeping body.
Best story ever. But then I say that every time we put up a story, right? Okay, so here we are enthusiastically advocating all ages to go read these books, which were obviously written with kids in mind. And yet, when I read Edward the Emu to my friend, my adult friend Kate, who happened to be visiting, she was enthralled the entire story. We had some good laughs, we were glad that we were visiting, and you know what, I always feel lighthearted when I put one of these stories up.
We just want to say, it's just an amazing adventure that you can go on anytime at all. Tell us what you think.
Yeah. I think the best feedback we ever got for this was from one of our regular readers who said she was thanking us for putting it up because she could go any time of the day or night. She could take her child or not. She could read one page. She could read four pages. She could read the whole book. She could read it repeatedly. There was no admission. She didn't have to bring anything with her to do this. She said there were no rules. She just made them up as she went along. Mm-hmm. And it was so fabulous to get that feedback.
Some people do all of the actions we talked about in between each page, and some people come just to read the story.
Yep.
It's up to you how you're going to enjoy and take in the story block.
The other neat thing that I discovered was last year when we opened up these boards, mm-hmm. We invited everybody to come and read the story, and we had a lot of people come, and I was taking pictures of people as they were doing the story. Everyone reads the story slightly differently.
That's a really fun part about it, right?
Yeah.
We've heard that feedback from other people too. They come with someone different who reads the story in just a smidge of a different way. And all of a sudden you have a new adventure.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Come and do story
walk.
We're
pretty smitten with it.
And finally, I want to read you one line that really leaped off the page for me. Brother Catfail knew better than to be in a hurry where souls were concerned. There was plenty of elbow room in eternity. Well, Zed, that's it for Getting Mysteriously Cozy, the second in a 3-part series on mystery novels on Tungsten, Bulletproof Hacks for the Moth-Eaten. Tungsten may or may not be produced by Christine Bruce, possibly aired through CICK 93.9 FM in Smithers, BC, but probably available anytime on smithersradio.com or anywhere you get your podcasts. We may or may not reconvene at the same time next week for the third episode, entitled Wallet Litter. Nothing like a good spy novel. Or is there? In case you need a little fix this week, I'll leave you with a hack. Get on over to Walnut Park Elementary School and read this month's story walk, The Dot, by Peter H. Reynolds. I'm feeling confident that the story will inspire you, or at least make you feel glad you got up today.